Hey, welcome to the podcast. It was a contentious one right from the beginning because Stu is a racist when it comes to 007. Just a total and complete racist. Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
And Glenn wants to just sacrifice your entire culture to the social
would you
justice
like
warriors.
To, would you like to have me point out the use of the word D-E-G-O? Huh? Would you like me to your use of that?
I said it was the two words, day and go, that happened to me next week.
Please don't bring it up anymore. Anyway, so very contentious. We have Tim Alberta on, who wrote a new book called American Carnage. We asked him a few questions about his book. Fascinating behind the scenes about our Vice President Pence. I asked him the question, do you think Pence might not be our Vice President? Could it be Nikki Haley? He gave an answer to that. Also, Ilhan Omar. Is she married to her brother? What is the deal with that? John Solomon on his latest lawsuit with the Department of State to obtain the communications between the Department of State and Joe Biden. An explosive story on that. And also, Showtime's portrayal of a very talented TV guy.
You mean the armadillo with a hairpiece? Glenn Beck?
All that and more on today's podcast.
You're listening to the best of the Glenn Beck program.
We can only hope that I have another vocal cord experience this summer. Oh, that would be great.
We could bring in a black woman to replace you.
We could. We could. Mm-hmm. We could. And I wouldn't have a problem with that.
No, it's time. I think it's time, right? For a little diversity.
You know, if there was a black woman that had, you know, my traits, having her on, mm-hmm. giving her opinions on this show would be fine.
Well, of course it would.
Right.
Yes.
Your problem is you think James Bond is being replaced by a black woman, and James Bond is a guy.
That's
true.
So you're the problem.
I'm the problem here. Yeah.
Jesus, love of feet.
I'm just
tired. No, you want to have it. Wait.
Of the diversity.
Right. If you want to have a
mandate.
Problem. I know. If you want to have a problem, with the guy who is replacing James Bond as James Bond. He's always been a white guy. Mm-hmm. He's not a black man. He's always been a white guy. If you want to have that conversation, okay.
What is he now?
He's white.
He's still white.
James Bond, yes.
Who's replacing Daniel Craig?
The guy who, he's great actor. Don't remember his name. He's a black guy, but not in this Bond movie.
but not in this one. Is becoming Bond.
What?
Right? A black guy is becoming
Bond.
Yeah,
is becoming Bond. And so, you know, if you want to just, you know, flush all of the history of this guy with it was like what's his name did one Bond movie and he was like sensitive and I'm not going to be bad with
Timothy
women.
Dalton.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. Mm-hmm. That's not James Bond.
Right.
Mm-hmm. We know who James Bond is. He's a white guy from Scotland.
Right.
We got it. Yeah. Okay. He's not a black guy.
Right.
Now, that one you could have an intellectual argument over on. Let's stop changing the stories. Can we please stop changing the stories just for political correctness? Mm-hmm. But can we move on with our lives? Because it's freaking James Bond. The 007 status in this particular movie, James Bond is still Daniel Craig. And James Bond is pissed because his 00 status is gone and he wants it back from the new person that has that 00 status.
And
so he's still
person.
James Bond.
Right. So and then they're just so basically what they've come up with a way to justify the diversity move here in the story and you're accepting it. That's essentially what we're learning.
I'm trying not to hate everybody and everything.
No, I'm trying
not to be. Guys, I was just in New York for the last week.
Well, I know. And speaking
it is
of that,
the worst.
Like Hamilton was interesting because I don't know if you know this. Alexander Hamilton wasn't black.
What? Shut up.
What are you talking about?
No, he wasn't. He was a white guy. He was a white guy. Now, what if you'd made Martin Luther King?
A white guy.
Can you imagine the
hang on just a second. Wait. So would you have a problem? Because I wouldn't. Would you have a problem with a great actor who happened to be black playing one of our founders if it wasn't all about this stupid diversity thing. So in other words, a great actor could play Malcolm X or Martin Luther King. It would be hard. You have to go farther away.
Let's go the other way. Is it okay for, you know, a white person to play black people? We look back at that in history and we say that's negative, right? We look back at blackface and say that's a bad idea unless you happen to be governor of Virginia. It's a really bad idea.
Right, because it was demeaning. If you played the role right, it still would not be acceptable in our society because of political correctness.
But it's just also dumb. Right, like there's you know what, there's black people and black founders, by the way. Yeah. They can have black people play black founders. It'd be great to see some freaking movies about that.
Yeah,
I'd love
to
see
that. It would.
Tell the real story.
It would.
Which we've done.
It would.
Then you see Scarlett Johansson getting in trouble because she said she should be able to play anyone she wants. Right. She should be able to play any tree
or whatever
that she wants. And that's being seen as this like, oh my gosh, I can't believe.
How dare she? Well, because she got a role taken from her because she's not trans. So I guess now only trans people can play a trans role.
And that's stupid.
It's stupid.
But wait a minute. Hang on just a second. What's the difference between white and black?
Right, exactly. I think it's just the real visibility, right? I think Daniel Craig took some heat at the beginning when he was named Bond because he was too short. Like, this guy's too short to be Bond. People noticed that.
Well, no, yeah, but that's ridiculous.
Well, but it's not.
Tom Cruise is 5'1".
Right, but Tom Cruise is playing like Tom Cruise.
Tom Cruise is standing on a box. Like 5'7". You just can't see him standing on the box.
And because it's hidden, you can't do that with skin color. It's just a really obvious trait.
Right.
Right. Right. You can't do it like even if it's like long hair. Right, like there's things that you can alter to make the person appear like the person they're playing, and so you do those things. You can't do it with skin color. That's why it's the most obvious one.
I have to tell
you, or gender.
The hate here. We need Marianne Williamson here because the hate that is happening on this show right now
is overwhelming.
That's true.
Now I don't know. Yeah. Did you guys hear the Marianne Williamson prayer?
I have not yet.
Now this is not cult-like at all. This does not feel like some sort of spooky, you know, what's that name of that movie, Somar or something? That movie that's out right now? Yeah. It's nothing like this.
Definitely doesn't sound like Get Out Part 2. There's definitely
no.
You're not going to feel that here.
Here it is.
As I speak, I'm going to ask the white Americans in the room to please repeat after me.
Okay.
On behalf of myself and on behalf of my country, to you and all African Americans, from the beginning of our nation's history, in honor of your ancestors and on behalf of your children, please hear this from my heart.
Can't be from your
heart. I apologize. Please forgive us. With this prayer, I acknowledge the depth of the evils that have been perpetrated against black people in America.
It's too long.
America.
From slavery to lynchings. To white supremacist laws, to the denial of voting rights, to all the ways, both large and small, all of them evil, all of them wrong, for all the oppression and all of the injustices. I apologize.
Is this a never-ending prayer?
Yes. Yeah, I know. The Lord is like, okay, all right.
I got it,
for the love of Pete. Okay, so does she then say, now, turn around and reverse this?
Oh, surely they just left that out of the video.
So she doesn't do that.
Are you saying that black people have to apologize for something, Glenn?
I think all Americans need to apologize for a lot of stuff.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. We've done that on this show where I've come out and said, hey, I made some mistakes and I apologize. It's always good to apologize. It's always good to recognize someone else's pain. Mm-hmm. But it can't be a one-way street unless it's God. on the other end. When you're apologizing to God, you don't go, well, it's your turn now. Okay? He has nothing to apologize for. But everybody else has something to apologize for. There's nothing wrong with this recognition if it would just stop there. But this isn't going to stop there.
Well, except these aren't the people that are responsible for slavery and discrimination laws.
Yeah, that's where the real issue is. There,
yeah,
right?
No, like, I know.
It's not them.
And
they didn't do it.
What a creepy moment if you happen to be one of the African Americans there.
Like, there's and just they're being touched during that time?
Touched like, the entire time throughout the 12-minute prayer. And they've got their hands on the guys. There's like apologizing. Wouldn't you? I mean, every African American I think I've ever met would be like, dude, first of all,
hands off.
Yeah. Second of all, you don't need to apologize to me for something that you weren't even alive for.
Agree with you, and I think many African Americans agree with that as well. The ones who are
going to Marianne Williamson prayers.
Pull themselves up by the bootstraps, they are not there. However, we do know that it is important through AA and through all religious organizations, it is important to recognize the pain of others and just to say it's good and I apologize, I am with you, blah blah blah. But the problem with it is it doesn't stop there. Now I have to pay you reparations. No, wait a minute, what? I'm recognizing your pain. I had nothing to do with you causing your pain, but I am recognizing your pain because you are a human being just like I am. And when I have pain, it feels good for somebody to come up to me and say, I'm sorry for the loss of your mother. Okay, you didn't kill my mom, dude. Why are you sorry? Because I'm recognizing your pain. And so when it stops at that, I'm sorry for your loss. When it stops there... Okay, but it doesn't stop there. What happens is, I'm sorry for the loss of your mother. I know. Thank you for that. Now, pay me money.
Right. I mean, I know Williamson in particular is advocating for about $500 billion in reparations.
Well, we have it.
We've got plenty of extra money.
Yeah.
We're the richest nation on earth.
Yeah.
That's the least we can do.
Amen.
The least we can do.
I think she's the one that said it was anything under $100 billion is an insult. Like, it would be
she's right.
If we gave if we gave African Americans, and again, how you'd figure out who gets the money and who doesn't, whatever, that's impossibly complicated. But if we gave them only $99 billion, that would be an insult. Just the $99 billion.
What about the African Americans that would find it insulting to take reparations? And what about the African Americans who didn't have here?
Well, here's the thing: we don't need any more black faces that aren't black voices.
Wait, what?
Oh, yeah, no. You can't do that right before I go into a commercial. You cannot do that. Stand by. Forget you heard that, because that is another can of worms we're about to open up.
The best of the Glenn Beck program.
Hey, it's Glenn, and if you like what you hear on the program, you should check out Pat Gray Unleashed. His podcast is available wherever you download your favorite podcast. Tim Alberta on with us. His new book just came out today, American Carnage, and I would imagine it's going to get a lot of coverage in the media because people will say this is an anti-Trump book. However, I just got this copy today, so I don't know. But there are a lot of interesting things in this book, and everybody is on the record in this. This is not a hatchet job, at least that I can see at this point. Tim Alberta is with us, author of American Carnage. Is this a bash Trump book?
Good morning, Glenn. Well, no, I don't think it's a bash Trump book. In fact, I sat with the president in the Oval Office for a pretty lengthy interview for the book, and I think that I was awfully fair to him, and I actually just got off the phone with somebody at the White House about 20 minutes ago and had a nice conversation about the book.
Okay.
I think the book examines the president and his administration for what it is, nothing more, nothing less.
So it was interesting to me because there's a lot of things in here that I have never heard before. For instance, the way Pence... went and was kind of pursuing Donald Trump, which I didn't know, and the things that he had done trying to say, well, if this doesn't happen, then this vice presidency is not supposed to happen. And he actually spent the weekend with Donald Trump. And what he said about Trump afterwards was pretty remarkable, I thought.
Yeah, you know, their relationship is, I think, pretty poorly understood. And it's obviously an incredibly important relationship because most people in the president's orbit, and I think the president himself, believe that he would not have won the election in 2016 without Mike Pence on the ticket.
Right.
And obviously, they're two very different individuals. I've covered Mike Pence for a number of years. I know him and know the people around him pretty well. And Pence went from being the pursued to being the pursuer very, very quickly, and it was very surprising to many of his friends. And essentially, the backstory in a nutshell, Glenn, is that once Pence actually met Trump and spent the weekend with him and got to know his family and they played golf together a couple of times, he sort of became convinced that the caricature of Donald Trump was very different from the person, Donald Trump. And that began this very sort of odd couple relationship. And I don't need to go chapter and verse on all the differences between the two men. But Pence came away from all of it thinking, you know what, not only do I like this guy, but I would love to get on a ticket with this guy.
Yeah, he said that he is really inquisitive. And you don't get that from the president at a distance. That he is, that he was constantly asking Pence questions about everything. And he said he was extremely sharp. Again, another thing that you don't really get from the mainstream media and Donald Trump's appearances.
Yeah, Trump's executive style here is pretty interesting. He has never been, you talk to people who work with him in the business world, he's never been somebody who wants long meetings, very structured day, conference calls, things like that. Trump essentially gets information by quizzing people, almost interrogating people, like rapid fire style, and he kind of takes what he needs and he discards the rest. And that has been sort of his reputation in business and now in politics. And it's funny, Glenn, if you talk with, you know, Republican lawmakers who will go over to the White House, they'll sort of walk out of there in a daze, and they're not quite sure what just happened, and they think that he absorbed some of the things they were trying to tell him. And in reality, to Trump's mind, you know, 90% of what they're telling him, he doesn't care about. He feels like it's ephemeral and or that it's peripheral to the matter at hand. And he is sort of trying to filter out some of the political BS and just sort of focus on, you know, the crux of what it is they're trying to get him to do or not do, you know, depending on the day.
I was interested in the part of the book where you're talking about AOC, that Trump admires her. And this is really very, you have to really understand the context here. But he admires her and says she's Evita.
Ava Perón, Evita. Yeah, it was probably the most surprising moment in our interview. And as a quick way of background, we were talking about populism, and I was trying to understand from the president, you know, philosophically, what does it mean to be a populist? And so I was asking him, for instance, about, you know, AOC had proposed this tax on the ultra wealthy. And I was asking him, you know, because there was polling showing at the time, you know, a whole body of polling showing that this wasn't popular just among liberals, but actually there are a lot of blue collar conservatives who don't mind at all this idea of a tax on the very, very wealthiest members of society. So I was trying to get at that with the president, and he was pretty evasive on that question. But then unsolicited, he basically started writing a love letter to AOC and telling me how, you know, on the one hand, he doesn't think she knows anything and that, you know, she's got a lot of learning to do and that she's over her skis, but he was enamored of her. And he, you know, I just reading between the lines, he did not say this verbatim, Glenn, but I could sort of tell that Donald Trump, I think, sees in AOC a little bit of himself, which is to say that he sort of exposed the old Republican establishment as kind of feeble and slow and incompetent and a little bit complacent. And AOC has really begun to do the same thing to the Democratic establishment. And I think he sort of tips his cap to her and recognizes the talent that she has in kind of overturning the old order.
Right. And so it's not a love affair with her policies or anything else. He just...
No.
Because I think the same thing. She's effective until I saw the DNC polling numbers that they leaked out about her, where, you know, they have around 9% popularity in the country, which is pretty astounding. Can we go to the TikTok, if you will, of the Access Hollywood crisis?
Sure.
Tell the story of what happened that day.
Well, you know, the short version is that this is Friday morning in October, and on that Sunday night, Trump was preparing to debate Hillary Clinton in St. Louis. It was their second presidential debate. So they were holed up in the 25th floor in a conference room at Trump Tower, and it's Donald Trump and Chris Christie at a table. Chris Christie is portraying Hillary Clinton in this debate prep session, and Reince Priebus, the chairman of the party, he's acting as the moderator. And the president's advisors and some of his family members are in the room, and they're all kind of offering some feedback. And one by one, everyone in the room starts to leave, which is pretty unusual. And at one point, Reince Priebus looks up and he kind of scans the room, and it's just the three of them, he and Trump and Christie. And Priebus says to Trump, you know, when everybody leaves the room at the same time, something's going on. And at that moment, Trump, who hadn't really realized it either, he looks outside of the room and he can see through the plate glass doors that all of his high command of the campaign is gathered, sort of whispering in hushed tones just outside of the conference room. And Trump yells at them. He says, yeah, what the hell is going on out there? And there's this long passing moment where nobody quite knows what's happening. And finally, the door swings open, and Hope Hicks, the communications director for the campaign, she comes in, hands a stack of papers to Donald Trump. We know now that that stack of papers was a printed out email exchange with a Washington Post reporter who had obtained that Access Hollywood tape. And Trump is reading through the remarks, and he suddenly stops very abruptly when he sees some of the vulgar remarks. And he says, this doesn't sound like me. I don't think this is me. And Reince Priebus is losing his mind at this point because he's saying, what the hell is going on? Somebody please tell me something. So Trump gives the papers to Reince Priebus. Priebus sees the same comments, and he basically immediately says, this is fatal. I mean, we're done. This is it. This is as bad as it gets. Really, the only person in the room at that point who thought that it wasn't lethal to the campaign was Jared Kushner. And he pipes up and says, you know, I don't think it's all that bad. And everyone sort of rolled their eyes. But basically, everyone else in the room that day, from Steve Bannon to Dave Bossie, Kellyanne Conway, the president's children, they all thought that this was it, that he was toast. And, you know, explain how he survived the weekend, essentially.
Did the president feel that he was toast, or did he know, I can get past this?
You know, from everything my reporting has told me, Glenn, that was the one moment in the campaign where he felt like that things were probably cooked, that he was already fighting a little bit of an uphill battle, that, you know, he had professionalized the campaign a little bit and surrounded himself with some really good people who are veterans and who had a lot of polling and you know, data analytics to show him that this was going to be really tough, that he'd really have to pull off an inside straight. But they weren't pessimistic up until that point. I think that weekend did hit Trump that, you know, I probably am going to lose. But that made him all the more defiant, frankly. He was going to lose on his terms. He wasn't going to be pushed out of the race.
So there's another piece here from the RNC colluding with Rubio's campaign and the South Carolina GOP to stack the debate hall against Trump heading into that primary. And I remember that it was quite a lively debate in South Carolina. But this is the same thing that the DNC was doing to Bernie Sanders in favor of Hillary Clinton, is it not?
Yeah, well, it's similar. I think the difference is that, you know, Hillary Clinton was always looking at a coronation as the Democratic Party's nominee. And obviously there were some folks in the party establishment on that side who were just sort of annoyed with Bernie Sanders and kind mm-hmm. of viewed him as a pest and wanted to get him out of the way. Whereas on the Republican side, Donald Trump was becoming a runaway train. After winning the New Hampshire primary by nearly 20 points, everyone in the party apparatus who had sort of scoffed at Trump for the better part of the past year was suddenly coming to terms with the fact that this guy was not only the front runner, but probably the prohibitive front runner, because he had placed second in Iowa and then he had, you know, cleaned everyone's clock in New Hampshire. So there was this reckoning, Glenn, after the New Hampshire primary. They had 10 days until South Carolina. And during that period of time, I document it in the book, you had, you know, senior party officials reaching out to top party consultants talking about trying to orchestrate some sort of 11th hour kind of pirate operation to take down Trump. You had all kinds of talk about Oppo leaks. You had Mark Short, who of course now works in the White House, a very prominent White House official, but Mark Short at the time was running the Koch brothers political network, and he went to Wichita and asked them for $10 million to take down Trump on Super Tuesday. Essentially, the fear among all of these folks was that if he won South Carolina, he would then have such a head of steam heading into Super Tuesday that this thing was going to be a runaway. And so what the RNC actually did And that's Sean Spicer, who, of course, became press secretary. Sean Spicer and Katie Walsh and some others inside the RNC, they got together with the South Carolina Republican Party, the chairman which is a guy named Matt Moore. He did not like Trump. And they got together with the Rubio campaign, and essentially they stacked the debate hall with Rubio supporters who drowned out Trump in boos, basically everything he said that night.
Wow. How did Spicer end up on Trump's team?
Well, how did any of these people wind up on Trump?
He was working for he was working against the president. Well, I guess they all kind of were. Priebus was as well. That's a stupid question. I retract that.
It's true, though. Throughout the book, that's a recurring thing where these people who were very anti-Trump during the campaign wind up with roles in the, including Pompeo, which is something I had never heard before from the book. Tim, can you go through Pompeo and?
Can I take a break and have you come back?
Oh, okay.
Just take a break and then we'll come back in just a second. More. The name of the book is American Carnage. On the front lines of the Republican Civil War and the rise of President Trump.
This is the best of the Glenn Beck program.
Hey, it's Glenn, and I want to tell you about something that you should either end your day with or start your morning with, and that is The News and Why It Matters. If you like this show, you're going to love The News and Why It Matters. It's a bunch of us that all get together at the end of the day and just talk about the stories that matter to you and your life. The News and Why It Matters. Look for it now wherever you download your favorite podcast. I want to spend some time today on AOC and also another member of Congress, part of the squad. Stu is working on looking at all of the poll results that are coming out now, leaked from the Democratic Party, which I find fascinating. He'll give us a look at that coming up in a second. First, let me start with a story of, I like to call it the Tale of Two Ahmads. 3 weeks ago, the Minneapolis Star Tribune, hardly a conservative publication, published a 2,300-word story with updates about the Ilhan Omar scandal. Nothing was said. Now, see if this sounds like a big story to you. A current member of Congress may have married her brother for immigration purposes and tax purposes and then lied about it. The same member of Congress also clearly violated federal and state tax law. Now, this sounds like a supermarket headline, but it's not. It's not coming from a conspiracy theorist website. No, no, no. It's coming from the oh-so-credible Minneapolis Star Tribune. Now, Omar and her representatives, the immunity here is apparently off the charts because the mainstream media will not go near this story. It's not that they don't care, because they would care if it was anybody else. They are making a conscious choice to stay away from this story, because perhaps they're part of the squad. But let me give you the headline from the Minneapolis Star Tribune. New documents revisit questions about Representative Ilhan Omar's marriage history. Now, when the story first surfaced in 2016 that she may have married her own brother to get around immigration laws, Omar called it baseless rumors. It's just crazy internet stuff. But last month, as the state of Minnesota invested campaign finance violations by Omar, it found that she had filed federal taxes in 2014 and 2015 with her current husband, Ahmed Hirsi, even though she was still legally married to a different Ahmed with the last name of Elmi. So the two Ahmeds, and you're going to have to pay close attention here, because there's two Ahmeds. Remember, there's Ahmed Hirsi, her current husband, and Ahmed Elmi. Now, let me walk you through this. From this point, I'm just going to go with the last names of her two husbands, Hirsi and Elmi. Now, this is how Omar's campaign orders her marriage timeline. Listen to this. In 2002, when she was 19, Omar marries Hirsi. That's her current husband. She marries Hirsi. According to the Star Tribune, they married in their faith tradition, those are in quotes, in Minnesota, which means, because it's the married in the faith tradition, they didn't file any paperwork, so she wasn't officially married to him. Omar and Hersey proceed to have two children together over the next 6 years, but then they decide to divorce. But remember, they were never officially married. They just got a divorce in their faith tradition, not a legal divorce because they weren't legally married. The following year, Omar now is 26, and she legally gets married to a different Ahmed, Ahmed Elmi. He's 23. So it was a quick rebound. And this one, she doesn't want to marry in her faith tradition. She marries in the legal tradition. He's 23. She identifies him as a British citizen. Now, according to the Star Tribune, Elmi's school records show he went to high school in St. Paul and attended North Dakota State University. 2 years later, in 2011, Omar and Elmi divorce in their faith tradition. But I thought they were married not in their faith tradition, they were married in the legal tradition. Well, whatever that is, they decide not to legally divorce. So in 2012, Omar gets back together with her first sort of husband, Hersey, you know, the father of her two children. That year, they have a third child together. So she just went off and married somebody else, but got a divorce in the faith tradition, but not really a divorce. Goes back to her husband, who she had a faith divorce. Following year, she gets elected to Minnesota's State House of Representatives. Now, remember, in 2014 and 2015, Omar and Hersey, the faith tradition husband, file joint tax returns, but they're still not legally married. She was still legally married to Ahmed Elmi, so I guess it was just a clerical error. The following year, she gets elected to the Minnesota State House of Representatives, and her campaign is plagued with allegations that Elmi is not just her lover and her husband, but instead her brother that she married for immigration purposes. According to the Star Tribune, new documents reveal efforts by Omar's campaign in 2016 and again in 2018 when she was elected to the U.S. House to keep her marriage to Elmi out of the media. In 2016, Omar's campaign releases the names of six of Omar's siblings, but only their first names, and Ahmed Elmi is not on the list. In 2017, while serving in the Minnesota House, Omar legally divorces Elmi. But I think she's still married to Ahmed, the first one, right? Then there's a small matter of possible perjury, because in her divorce proceedings, Omar claims that she hasn't seen or made contact with Elmi since 2011. That's under oath. Unfortunately, there are social media posts with photos of Omar and Elmi together in London in 2014. Oops. That content was deleted after Omar began running for political office. Now, the Star Tribune says it's been unable to independently obtain the original posts. They say the Star Tribune is skeptical of the posts that are still viewable on what it calls conservative activist sites like PJ Media. Well, that doesn't make any sense. You could easily find out if that picture has been altered. In 2018, before she's elected to Congress, Omar finally legally marries her husband, the first one, Hersey. Hopefully that she has the right Ahmed at the marriage license. I don't know, because the bloggers won't stop talking about it. They're so hateful. The Star Tribune reports that their investigation could, quote, neither conclusively confirm nor rebut the allegation that Elmi is Omar's sibling. So it's a definite maybe. Omar and Hersey still refuse to answer any questions about the Elmi situation. Elmi now seems to be in Africa, according to social media posts. He's not talking either. But here's the thing. In a separate investigation, the Washington Examiner viewed public documents, including 24 traffic violations and misdemeanor charges against Hersey that list he and Ilhan Omar's home address as being the same residence from 2009 to 2011. So just to make sure you're totally clear on this, she divorces her husband and the kids, then legally marries another man where they all move into the same house. Okay. Now, that contradicts Omar's claim that she was separated from Hersey during that time frame. According to the public documents, Omar and Hersey lived at the same address when she she legally was married to Elmi, which is weird, very awkward. But, hey, Donald Trump hates people, so pay attention to that. Finding out if Elmi is Omar's brother would seem like a pretty easy thing to figure out. But not when your family immigrated to the U.S. from a war-torn country like Somalia that had a bad government record-keeping system. There are no records of birth certificates, so we don't know. Omar won't answer the question about her marriages, and she refused to make her tax and immigration records available to the Star Tribune or any other outlet. Apparently, people who petition the U.S. government for a visa on behalf of a sibling who is not a citizen may have to wait 12 or more years to get one, but applications for spouses are processed much more quickly. Is this what Omar was doing for Elmi, if he is indeed a brother? We still don't know for sure. But regardless of that, we don't know if they're siblings or not. She still broke federal and state laws by filing taxes jointly with Hersey while being legally married to Elmi in the same house. During a deposition before the Campaign Finance and Public Discourse Board last December, Omar said she was unaware that she violated tax law by filing joint married returns with Hersey. She told the board she couldn't remember amending her tax filing to correct the problem either. You know how it is when you forget that you got married at that one time to that other person who's still living in your house. Sometimes it can be very confusing when you're trying to just figure out your taxes. Maybe if you're lucky enough to land on the ideology and intersectionality charts in the same area as Ilhan Omar, where claiming ignorance before a state board will get you off the hook, maybe you'll someday be lucky enough to have that intersectionality. But I doubt most of us will ever be so lucky.
You're listening to the best of the Glenn Beck Program.
Hey, it's Glenn, and if you like what you hear on the program, you should check out Pat Gray Unleashed. His podcast is available wherever you download your favorite podcast. John Solomon is an award-winning investigative journalist. He is the executive vice president at The Hill. He previously worked for the Associated Press, The Washington Post, and The Washington Times. He is a guy who has been following this story about Joe Biden and his son from the beginning, and he's getting blocked. But I want to start, John, with give a summary of what you're looking for and what the story is for people who haven't been following it.
That's a great idea. Thanks, Glenn. So there is a pattern when Joe Biden was vice president of his son, Hunter, kind of following in the vapor trail and cashing in on his father's official government portfolio. 2013, Joe Biden goes to China for an official government trip. Hunter Biden goes on the plane with him, comes back with a $1 billion contract from Chinese officials.
It's crazy.
That's a big number. In 2014, Hunter Biden, who admits he has a long-running drug problem and was kicked out of the Navy for testing positive for cocaine, he's in a kind of difficult period of his life. He just got kicked out of the Navy. 2014, Joe Biden is named Obama's point man for the crisis in Ukraine after the Russians invaded Crimea. What happens? Joe Biden gets working in Ukraine. All of a sudden, Ukraine's largest natural gas company puts Hunter Biden on its board and begins paying him hundreds of thousands of dollars a month, or at least his company hundreds of thousands of dollars a month. He collects about $3 or $4 million himself, or his company does, in the final 2 years of the Obama administration. So Hunter Biden, again, cashing in on his father's government portfolio.
Well, now, wait a minute. The gas and oil company might have needed somebody who was directly out of rehab, had no gas or oil experience, and couldn't speak the language. They may have been looking for somebody just like that.
Sounds like a good resume pitch.
It does.
Yeah, I think you've caught the suspicion right on its head. And we weren't alone, right? The Ukrainian prosecutors, the General Prosecutor's Office of Ukraine, began to look into the fact, why is this American with no gas experience but with lots of political connections getting these millions of dollars? And in late 2015, they were preparing to interview Hunter Biden. Why are you taking this money? What's it being used for? What's the benefit to the Ukraine economy?
Stop for a second. Are you sure? Yeah. Do you have the proof that that is what they were going to interview him about?
I do indeed. I've interviewed the prosecutor who actually was going to conduct the interview, a guy named Shokin, and I have the official case file that the general prosecutors had that showed or declared their interest in seeking to interview Joe Biden about the payments he was receiving as an American board member. So that is not in dispute. And recently, Shokin gave the same story to ABC News and confirmed my earlier reporting to ABC News. So it's been given now in two clear media outlets that that was the case. So Joe Biden then proceeds to force the Ukrainian president to fire this prosecutor. And we know Biden did this because Biden bragged himself on a videotape. He did it. He said, I told the Ukraine president, you don't fire that prosecutor, you don't get your $1 billion in loan guarantees in March 2016. Well, Ukraine was on the brink of financial collapse. If the U.S. had pulled that $1 billion in loan guarantees, it would have collapsed. And so it was a very powerful threat by Joe Biden. And sure as heck, the prosecutor is fired by the president in March of 2016. Now, Joe Biden's story is, I didn't know he was under investigation, and I certainly didn't fire the prosecutor because my son was in some form of jeopardy. We want to test that theory because our sources indicate that during this entire time while this was going on, Burisma and Hunter Biden and others were having contacts with the U.S. government and possibly the State Department. Makes sense. If you're an American overseas being investigated by a foreign power, you might turn to your State Department to get help. That's what the State Department's there for. Those are the documents we're seeking to test whether Joe Biden and Hunter Biden's story to the American public, now that Joe Biden is running for president, is true and accurate. And we have reason to believe that there are documents that show contacts between Hunter Biden, Burisma, and others, and their representatives, including an American lobbying firm named Blue Star Strategies, that they were having contacts with the State Department and letting the U.S. government know this prosecutor was putting pressure on them, and that might have preceded Joe Biden's decision to get the prosecutor fired. So that's why we're suing, and with the good help of the Southeastern Legal Foundation, we now have a lawsuit in front of a federal judge, and hopefully we'll get the American public some transparency.
When are they supposed to rule on this? How long will it take?
Well, my experience with FOIA lawsuits, they take anywhere from 4 months to a year. If you're lucky, it'll be 4 months. If it's not, it'll be closer into the middle of the election year next year. But whenever it comes out, I think it'll be valuable information. And there are elements of Joe Biden's public story that he's now crafted as a candidate for 2020 that simply don't match up to the documents and facts that I have. And we want to find out what the real truth is. So whether it's, a few months from now or the middle of the campaign next year, we're sticking with it, and we're going to get the truth.
So you don't have, you have a lot of loyalty to the Clinton camp, the Biden camp, the Obama camp in the State Department, and not a lot of loyalty to anybody that wants to upset that. How confident are you that these documents will still be producible, will be there?
That they're there. Yeah, well, the good thing is that under the Federal Records Act, most official government documents, Hillary Clinton's emails aside, because they were on a private server, they get preserved. And they get preserved in so many different ways, it's very difficult to make them disappear. We have a pretty good sense that these documents do exist now. I've had sources access some of them and give me a general sense of what is in them. Mm. So we will be able to identify for the court, if there's any shenanigans, what we believe these documents were, the dates of them, and what they are believed to say. My guess is that the State Department wasn't prepared for me to go to court and try to compel this, much like the State Department Department wasn't prepared to produce the document we found a few months ago, thanks to Dave Bossie and Citizens United. We produced the famous document of the State Department meeting with Christopher Steele 1 month before Election Day 2016. And, of course, that document has become so important to the Russia investigation that the IG report on Steele and FBI misconduct was delayed. So sometimes these lawsuits work, and you get real important information that changes the course of history, and we hope to do that with this Ukraine document now.
How, what does that say to you that you, through a tip, could produce a document on this Russia investigation that the
pretty remarkable
the inspector general couldn't find or couldn't produce? What does that say?
Wasn't given. Well, it says two things. One, the Christopher Wray FBI is still in a game of obstruction of trying to stop these reviews from finding the true conduct of the FBI. For whatever reason, whether it's sources and methods or otherwise, the FBI and the State Department both possess these documents. And neither one of them turned them over to any of the reviews. None of the congressional reviews, the House Intelligence, Senate Intelligence, knew anything about the document until we surfaced it. We knew that from Devin Nunes, from others on the Senate side. So what it does mean is you got to be thorough, right? You've got to use every lever of power you have to try to force these bureaucrats to give up information that is rightfully the American public. When you look at the document they withheld in the State Department, there was nothing sensitive or classified about it. It was just simply embarrassing to the FBI and the State Department, and they played a game of keep away, which doesn't benefit us all. And I think this pattern of keep away, particularly with Chris Wray at the helm of the FBI, is becoming more and more troubling. I think it's might have been one of the reasons why Attorney General Barr made some comments recently that he wasn't getting the answers he intended to get in the Russia probe. There is something going on between the Bureau and its overseers that is frustrating to those trying to get to the truth.
And how do you think all this ends? Do you think we're headed for a place of real conflict with the truth, and it's either all going to come out or it's going to go deeper inside and it's going to become a real dangerous infection. Which way do you think it's leaning?
I think because of the good work of Bill Barr and the Attorney General and his determined nature to get to the bottom of this, I think we are going to get to the truth. And he's got a lot of smart people around him that are providing him information. Devin Nunes, Mark Meadows, Jim Jordan, people who went head to head with the FBI the last 2 years and kind of know where the bodies are buried and where the truth still is being withheld. And I think the determination of Bill Barr will be the winning factor for all of us getting the truth. I can tell you later today, I hope to report a story that will hopefully put an end to this silly love affair that goes on and off between the news media and Christopher Steele. In the last week, we've had some stories come out suggesting, hey, maybe Christopher Steele was credible after all. He had a great interview with the IG, and maybe we have it all wrong. Maybe this whole thing that Republicans are talking about, that the Russia case was flawed, is just a ruse, and he's going to turn out to be redeemed at the end of this. I'm going to have a story today that I think will put a stake in the heart of those hopes. Mm-hmm. There's an FBI spreadsheet that kept over-under on each sentence in the Steele dossier. And when you see how far off the FBI found Christopher Steele's claims, you'll understand why that dossier should never have been used as evidence in the support of a FISA. So we'll be breaking that later today. Those sort of revelations make a big difference to getting the American people the truth.
One last question, and I know it's unfair because I doubt that you have done anything on it. I just wanted your gut reaction on what is being said about Jeffrey Epstein. That there are these rumors going around that he may have been an intelligence officer or asset of some sort.
Yeah, I haven't seen. I've done some reporting on the Epstein case, particularly back in 08, 09 when the original deal was consummated to get him off the hook. I have never seen that. Now, it is not uncommon, however, for businessmen who travel frequently to be contacted by the CIA or the NSA or the DIA for information. Hey, you're on a travel. You met with these foreign people. Could you tell us and, you know, help your country what you found out? Is there anything that we should know about? Mm-hmm. That's a very common practice, but there's a big step from going to that and being somebody like a Christopher Steele that had a signed contract with the United States government. Mm-hmm. I think the real factor lies in the judgments that were made by the Justice Department in the 08-09 timeframe.
John, thank you so much, and we'll look for your report today, and of course, give us an update on whatever is happening with your lawsuit trying to get information out of the State Department. Thank you so much, John.
Thank you very much.
You bet.
Bye-bye.
This is the best of the Glenn Beck Program.
I saw Russell Crowe talking about you.
You saw Russell Crowe talking about me. Are you watching The Loudest Voice?
The Loudest Voice.
The Loudest Voice.
The book
is The Loudest Voice in the room.
Right.
This is the Showtime series that they were all so excited about on the left that no one is watching.
Yeah, it was pretty bad results for ratings. The first.
I think it was the lowest miniseries, lowest rating original series that they have ever put on the air.
Yes. So yeah. it's not working out so great so far.
So it's just ever.
Though it is, I would say, you know, I mean, look, it's very unfavorable to Roger Ailes, the guy who put Fox News together. So that's
what
the
series is
about. I watched the first episode and I've bits and pieces of the others.
Okay, so I've watched the first two episodes and bits and pieces of the third. I think I start to make an appearance next episode.
Well, you kind of made your first appearance in the most recent episode. In just a bit piece. And I actually, they said one of the nicest things I've ever heard anyone say about you in it. the scene basically is they're trying to find a new host. And they come in and they present you as a potential host for Fox News. Mm-hmm. And Roger Ailes reacts to your photograph in a way. I thought it was certainly nicer than most people talk about you. Here it is.
Peck's agent sent this over.
Jesus. Armadillo with a hairpiece. Can't argue with the ratings. I mean, he took a black hole at CNN and turned into 600K in the demo. I mean, and he hates Obama. Set up a meeting.
So, yeah, you look like an armadillo with a hairpiece.
Yeah.
Which is,
I've never seen an armadillo with a hairpiece.
I put up a. Maybe we could get this made. Mm-hmm. Can we get this made for social media? An armadillo with a hairpiece, and put it next to Glenica side by side.
Mm-hmm.
Because I don't see it that much. And the funny thing about you is you actually have your own hair, which most people would not believe.
But I always think that it looks like a hairpiece.
You used to say you were the only person with their real hair that looks like they're wearing a hairpiece.
Yeah,
that was because if I remember correctly. You had blonde hair on the sides and gray hair on the top.
Yes, so it didn't look... I mean, most people, they have the gray hair on the sides come in first. I had the gray hair on the top come in.
Right.
So I looked like a reverse skunk.
Mm-hmm.
And I hated it. I just hated it. And then it all went white, and I still hate it. But, you know.
But it is yours.
But
like,
it's mine.
Not
it's all
a hair
mine.
Piece. Yeah.
It's all mine.
Now, whether you're part armadillo or not, I can't answer for that.
Well, I did do the DNA test with 23andMe. I did not see any armadillo in
you
me.
You did see Asian land bridge, though.
Yes, I did.
So an armadillo could have walked across that.
Or rolled.
Or rolled across.
Or rolled across, so you don't know.
They did a reference. The ratings success over at CNN Headline News, which was fun to hear.
So what have you what have you thought about this portrayal of Roger?
I mean, it's very negative in that the part. I have not seen a lot of the sexual abuse sort of stuff, which I know they get into later on.
So I saw part of that, I think, in this last one, maybe. And it's really ugly.
But
it's like really ugly.
Sure. But Russell Crowe does a pretty good Roger.
Like he does. I mean, think he looks like him. He
walks like him.
Walks just like him.
Yeah. I mean,
and it was and you know, they're trying to make him sound. They're trying to make him sound like some horrible, horrible human being on his political stuff. But there's stuff where, like, he's up with Rupert Murdoch. And he's like, I'm telling you, this guy is a Marxist. Oh, Roger, stop it. Stop it. I'm telling you, he's a Marxist. Well, I'm like, yeah, all right. You know, there's a lot of stuff in there that's really, really bad. But there's also some of the stuff that they're putting out there going, see, look what a hate monger he is. And I'm like... No, he was right.
And at some level, I think also in the book, and they do give him credit for being a visionary. I mean, there's no question about it. He figured out things.
You'll see the genius. I mean, one of the things they tried to make it look bad was he said, we're going to give the American people the America they want to believe in as well as the America as it truly is. Well, what's wrong with that?
Like a positive vision.
It's an aspirational
future, right?
Look. We're going to tell you we are these people, and we can achieve this kind of greatness. But here we are today. This is what we're doing today. That's just having a positive attitude, as I read it.
Yeah, I mean, they're going to say he's lying, right? He's saying no. The America they want it to be is the America where, you know, immigrants are ruining their lives, and it's not their fault. Yeah. And
sucks.
You know,
like, nobody who wants that.
If you, who would want that? Yeah,
who'd want that? Who'd watch that day and day? Just ask the four people that are remaining watching CNN.
Right.
You know, nobody wants to be told they suck all the time. You can be told, hey, we suck right now, but we don't have to suck because we got a bright future in front of us. Mm-hmm. There's nothing wrong with that.
No, I mean, that's a positive. It's interesting to see that. And they go into, you are going to have a meeting with Roger Ailes, I guess, in the next episode, or at least they're going to.
I don't think they do that.
I don't know if they're going to go into that much detail.
The meeting with Roger was, I had three meetings, didn't I?
I can't remember how many there were.
I can't remember. I only remember really the last one. We had three meetings. And the first one, he was just like, hey, just wanted to get to know you, blah, blah, blah. And didn't talk about a job or anything else. And then we had another meeting where they had started talking about a job. And I had said, no, I'm not interested, but I'll meet with you. And so I met with him. And I made the mistake of saying that I read his Wikipedia page. And he said, the first thing he said was, oh, great, we've got a genius that thinks Wikipedia is reliable. And I was like, oh, boy. And then he asked me, he sat down, didn't say anything. And I'm just trying to, you know, hey, so not nice restaurant, huh? And he's sitting there and he said the television is on behind him, and he looked up to, I think, Bill Shine, who was at the table, and he said, she's not smiling, is she? And Bill looks up at the TV monitor behind Ailes and says, no, she's not. He said, you can hear it. Tell her to GD smile. And it was like, and I was like, holy mother, what am I doing?
Because, I mean, you're talking about going on, and I mean, you could barely read, let alone
smile, read, and I don't do television. Right. You know, he doesn't understand. No, that was my first job. I've never even done live television before.
Right.
Okay. And he says, now in our first meeting, he says to me, you're the most talented television performer since Jack Parr. Now, that means something to me. Maybe it won't mean something to most people, but Jack Parr started The Tonight Show, and he was a storyteller, and he's like, you're the most talented since Jack Parr. Now, this meeting, none of that was around.
Well, now
he was not remembering any of that stuff, you know?
Now that he started to actually think about negotiating with you, he can no longer give you broad compliments.
And so he said to me, you know, tell her to GD smile. And then he just looks down his menu, and nobody says anything for at least, it felt like an hour, but it was probably about a minute. And then he looks up over his glasses, over his menu, over his glasses, and he's pretending to see what, you know, he's going to eat. Maybe he really is, but he looks up over his glasses and he says, tell me what you thought about the 1972 China-Nixon treaty. And I was like, don't, you know what, Roger? I'm.
Is that the one Forrest Gump was at?
Yeah, I know. I thought of some really funny things, and I didn't think he would laugh. No. And I said, you know, Roger, I'm not up on the 72 treaty. Sorry. Oh, he looks back down his menu. Then he looks up about, seemed like another hour. And then he looks up again and he said, well, tell me about Eisenhower. What were your thoughts of the policies of the Eisenhower administration? And I hadn't, I hadn't read anything about Eisenhower at the time. And I'm like, and I looked at him and I smiled and I said, you know, Roger, I could go one of two ways here. I could bluff, but I have a feeling you're way too sharp to bluff. Or I could possibly end this interview right now by saying, I got no idea. Not my area of expertise. I think I'm going with that one. He went, Then he didn't speak to me until the food arrived. Okay.
So you sat there in silence from the order time?
In silence. Then he said to me, "You're one of those Mormons." And I thought, oh, God.
This is a good meeting.
Yeah, this is going really well. And I said, yes, I am. And he said, "What was so wrong with the GD Catholic Church that you had to leave the church?" And I thought, oh, my gosh, I don't know what to even do here. And I said, well, you know, and I talked to him. And then he just kept asking me question, hard question after hard question. I realized about 90 minutes into it, when I had lost about 10 pounds of sweat, I realized he is only throwing me up against an electric fence to see how I react. All he's doing is, how are you? Because you're going to go on. I've been watching you. You're going to go on and you're going to say the things that you believe, and you're going to be strapped to an electric chair. How do you handle it? Now, he never said that to me, but that's what I was figuring towards the end. And I don't remember what the last question was, but it was 2 hours of just nonstop grilling, no niceties at all. And the two people that were also at the table, they weren't helping me. Because they were like, you know, that Roger had obviously said, stay still. And he
so
just
awkward.
He just took me on for 2 solid hours. And so he said, you want any dessert? And I'm like, no, I think I'm good. I never pass up dessert, but I'm good. And I put the fork down and get up and I put my coat on. And he didn't say anything. He puts his coat on and he comes up to me and he puts his hand on my shoulder. And he puts his hand out and he said, it was really nice sitting talking to you. And I didn't know what to say. And I was like, oh, no, this has been great. And he said, it's extraordinarily rare to meet a man who has the balls to say what he really believes. And even more so, to admit what he doesn't know.
The Blaze Radio Network. On demand.